Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Gail Hogan, and that music is from AMC's award-winning series Mad Men. The show chronicled life in the male-dominated advertising industry of the 1960s and depicted the harassment female employees endured as they advanced their careers. Sexual harassment in the workplace might seem like a relic of bygone eras, but as the recent allegations at Fox News shows up, that's not necessarily the case. And a recent study from the American Association of Advertising Agencies found that more than 50% of women in the industry report experiencing sexual harassment. Joining us now by phone is the CEO of the American Association of Advertising Agencies, Nancy Hill. Nancy, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Very happy to do so.
Also joining us here in the studio is professor at Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law, Camille Hebert, and her scholarship focuses on employment law, discrimination, and sexual harassment. Welcome back to the show, Camille.
Thanks for having me.
Nancy, I'm starting with you. In your survey, you said 50% of the women experienced sexual harassment in the workplace. Were you surprised at that number?
Actually, I was surprised that it was as low as it was.
Really?
Yes. And the reason I say that is because anecdotally, prior to doing the survey, I would have guessed that it would have been higher.
So do you think some women still weren't admitting to it?
It's interesting. This survey, the three or four questions that we released last week, we really haven't had time to crunch the numbers. We had not intended to release this survey data so early, but there have been a few high-profile instances of this kind of either language or behavior that have been covered widely by the press. So we decided to go ahead and do the cut early just on these particular questions. It's part of a broader study. What I did see is when you break it down by age, 33%, I believe, were middle management. Or no, sorry, 43% were middle management and 33% were senior management. So if you take those two numbers combined at 76%, this is probably people with 10 to 15 years experience in the industry. And I have a feeling that they're a little bit more willing to speak about it than the younger ones.
Why did you decide? You said there were several reasons that you conducted this survey. So why did you do it in the first place?
So earlier this year, there was a pretty high-profile lawsuit that was brought against a worldwide CEO in the industry, and it generated a lot of discussion just prior to one of our big events in March. And I gave a pretty publicized speech at the conference about the fact that this happens. It's not an isolated incident. And then there were a few comments that were made by high-profile CEOs who said that they believed it was a high-profile incident. So an isolated incident. So one of the things that drove us doing this survey was that we wanted to make sure that if anybody was in denial that it was isolated incidents, that we proved that it was not isolated.
Do you think advertising agencies have more instances of sexual harassment than other businesses?
I don't have any benchmarks to say yes or no definitively. I think part of what could be making it maybe a little bit higher of an instance is that in our industry, people work very long hours, very closely together. There's a lot of travel. I think that there's probably more
opportunity.
Yeah, I don't want to say opportunity because that makes it sound like it's a good thing, and it's not. But there's probably more of a situation where people could take advantage.
Camille, legally, I know there are two types of sexual harassment. Could you explain those, please?
So generally, what's known as quid pro quo sexual harassment is what sort of classically we used to think of as sexual harassment, which is sleep with me or you're fired, right? Tangible
yeah.
employment opportunities tied to employment decisions. The other form is hostile work environment, which is essentially any situation in which there isn't a tangible action. You're not fired directly because, but where it affects the terms and conditions of employment. So everything from touching to language to sort of all those series of conduct.
Innuendo, all those sorts of things.
All of those things.
Do women experience one type more than the other?
I think probably hostile environment sexual harassment is more pervasive because it can be conducted not only by supervisors, who are the only people who have the power to fire you, generally,
right.
but coworkers, subordinates.
But isn't that a harder one to prove?
Much harder. Much harder. Well, in some sense, quid pro quo is hard to prove because most people don't directly threaten your job in front of other people, in witnesses.
So it's a he said, she said type thing.
Sort of, yeah. Hostile environment is harder to prove because in order for it to be unlawful, it has to be what the courts call severe or pervasive, meaning it has to happen a lot or has to be really serious.
Camille, it's interesting because, you know, I think the word hostile puts a lot of people off because I think in many instances that feels a lot more overt than what is actually experienced.
I think you're right. I mean, hostile, that's sort of the legal term. Abusive, discriminatory, right? All those sort of other terms are used. Offensive, right? But I think sort of the idea is your work environment's adversely affected sort of in order to be unlawful.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm Gail Hogan, and we're discussing workplace sexual harassment this hour. If you have a question or comment, or you have been a victim of sexual harassment at work, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. In the end, Nancy, were you surprised at the results of the study overall?
No, again, because I'm in the position that I'm in and I'm a female in the industry of 30 years, I felt anecdotally that the numbers were probably low compared to what I hear. But I think, again, part of what we set out to prove was that this is not the incidents that we were seeing in the press were not isolated.
What kind of reaction have you gotten to this?
It's been incredible, actually. Here I am talking to you. I think that people needed – I think women needed the validation, and I think a lot of men needed their eyes opened. And anecdotally, I've heard from a lot of men who have said, thank you for doing this because, you know, again, because I don't practice this, I didn't think it was as widespread as it was.
Camille, are you finding more victims willing to take legal action if they feel harassed?
I do think as publicity happens and people see other people going forward, that women are more likely to come forward and report. There's still a fairly low level of reporting. That is, it's almost certain happens more than is reported, because women tend not to report for lots of reasons. Even those that report, a relatively small portion take legal action.
And some of the reasons are they feel like maybe they're being oversensitive?
Sometimes women and men, but it happens more often to women, tend to not report because they're not sure, right? That is, maybe he didn't really mean it. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm being oversensitive. Maybe I did something mm-hmm. to prompt it. Unfortunately, that also sort of people feel like that. And I think there's also a sense that when you come forward and report, it's not a very pleasant process.
Right.
That is what happens if you sue is people attack you to try to prove that you're making it up. It didn't really happen. You wanted it, those sort of things. And that tends to make women not report or not sue.
Would you say these type of lawsuits are being taken more seriously by the courts and business?
I think at least courts and businesses say they're taking them more seriously. I still think there are a lot of cases in which courts and probably businesses, although certainly I focus more on courts, tend to downplay how serious this is.
And what did you find, Nancy? You said there was some surprise by male ad executives. Do you see businesses as taking these, at least the ad business, this type of thing seriously?
I do think that they are taking it a lot more seriously. If you look at any of the headlines in our industry from the last 8 months, there's been incident after incident of high-profile male CEOs saying things or doing things that are completely inappropriate. And because they're largely owned by publicly held companies, I think they have no choice but to take this seriously at this point.
And Nancy, you said something interesting. These CEOs are high-level execs. How much of this sexual harassment doesn't necessarily have to do with sexual harassment as much as power?
Well, it's also your words. Words matter. And I think that many times people forget that what they say is equally abusive versus just a gesture or something physical. And if there's a constant stream of things that are completely inappropriate, it's a really big problem.
And what makes these folks think this is all okay is, you know, there are some people that say, and I've heard this, well, you know, they're from a different era, or they don't know any better because of, you know, the time they grew up. And I've heard that many times when they're talking about older men.
Yeah, and that's an excuse. And, you know, in my opinion, I think what's happening is that now that these CEOs who are of that quote-unquote other era are being challenged by the next generation, it's becoming more and more evident that they can't just continue to talk that way, walk that way, and behave the way that they've been behaving. Where it's been excused in the past, it's not being excused anymore.
You were shaking your head, Camille, rolling your eyes at that last comment.
I just have a hard time with that they didn't know any better.
Mm-hmm.
I agree.
I think they certainly knew better. They just thought they could get away with it.
And we allowed them to get away with it. That's the whole. It's they're of another era, and we just excused it
sure. For
so many years.
Right.
But in a way, is some of that true? Because people didn't talk about sexual harassment at work. So I'm not excusing behavior, but I'm thinking it was a different era and nothing was said. Camille?
I think that's right. I mean, it wasn't until relatively recently, the last 30, 40 years, we even had a word for it, right, that it became unlawful in that sense.
I'm going to take a call here. Let's see. Bob, you're on the air. You're on the air, Bob. Do you have a question?
Thanks for taking my call. I was wondering if there was any data on salary versus hourly employees. I know from my personal experience that my female friends in hourly positions seem to report much more severe cases of sexual harassment than those that are salary. And I could take the answer off the call.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. So I think he's talking about basically people in management positions as opposed to blue-collar workers. So what do you think, Camille?
I think probably to the extent that the harassment's about power, and I think usually it is about power, probably women in more subordinate positions are more likely to be harassed.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not exclusively there. Certainly management women are also harassed by their subordinates, by their superiors as well as their subordinates.
And Nancy, what do you think businesses still need to do to rectify the current climate in the workplace?
Well, I mean, certainly in our industry, part of the issue has been that at the very top of the agencies, it is largely a white male population. And when you have that kind of as one of my friends refers to it, closed loop of white men talking to white men as opposed to being inclusive with regard to both gender and ethnicity and all of the other things that go with diversity, you're going to continue to see this problem because they talk to each other and they don't see an issue with it. And I think in our industry, until we change the makeup of who is at the top of the agencies, that it's going to be very difficult because that's where the culture gets set.
Camille?
No, I agree. I mean, it's hard because I don't want to suggest that, you know, all white men are in the situation of engaging in sexual harassment. They aren't.
Exactly.
But I do think that's true, that there is sort of a power structure that's allowed it to continue. I always wonder, as women move into positions of power, whether some of them will engage in sexual harassment, right? But I think it's still less likely in that sense.
Well, Nancy, you've certainly started the discussion or at least continued it on another level, so we thank you for that.
You're welcome. I'm very happy to continue this discussion at any time.
We're talking about sexual harassment in the workplace. If you've experienced harassment on the job, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And coming up, how businesses can guard against sexual harassment in their company. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Gail Hogan. This hour, we're discussing sexual harassment in the workplace. It's been nearly 25 years since Anita Hill accused her former boss, Clarence Thomas, of sexual harassment during the hearing on his nomination to the Supreme Court. Though her testimony did not stop his nomination, it did spark a national conversation about sexual harassment. In a recent interview with NPR, Anita Hill put her experience in context.
If we look at 1991 and think about what happened, even though from the outside observer, it seemed that, in fact, I lost, I was treated very badly, women continued to come forward, and they came forward in record numbers. And that, I believe, is a good sign.
The recent story of former Fox News head Roger Ailes and allegations of sexual harassment has once again brought the issue into the spotlight. Still with us is professor at Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law, Camille Hébert. And joining us now by phone is psychologist and human resources consultant, Dr. Michelle Paludi. And Dr. Paludi is also an assistant dean at the Excelsior College School of Business and has written extensively on the issue of sexual harassment. Dr. Paludi, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for addressing this important issue.
Well, let me start with Anita Hill, since we just heard from her and heard from her in a recent interview. It's now 25 years later. How do we gauge the impact of her testimony and the news coverage on this issue?
Well, I agree with Professor Hill in that her testimony sparked women to come forward and to break silence about sexual harassment in the workplace. And while there isn't a one-to-one correspondence between incidents on anonymous surveys versus the number of people who come forward to file complaints with their employer, there has been an increase because of the understanding now that the organizations have a responsibility to engage in prevention of sexual harassment as well as doing investigations once put on notice. What Professor Hill contributed was to have women understand it's not their fault, that there is an organizational responsibility for prevention. It's not a person-to-person issue. It's an organization's responsibility. And when I have worked with women over the years since the Hill-Thomas hearings in 1991, that's a consistent issue they've brought up with to me, that they now believe that they can come forward because it took away from he said, she said to what is the organization supposed to do, what haven't they done, and how has this impacted me. For example, all organizations have to have a policy that's effective, that includes certain components, legal definition, behavioral examples, how to file a complaint, and effective and enforced procedures, including how they will maintain an individual's confidentiality, how they will prevent retaliation or respond to it if that has been brought to their attention, how long the investigation will take. And the third component is to provide training programs in sexual harassment on an annual basis for managers and employees that outlines general issues with respect to sexual harassment and then specifically what their organization will do should you be a survivor of sexual harassment, a respondent, or a witness for either party. When those are not present, then we have more women saying, this is something I need to address because the organization failed to do their duty based on law of how to prevent this from happening to me.
Well, Camille, she said based on law. Is it state law? Is it federal law? Is it broad-reaching? Is it very detailed?
So sexual harassment law is generally a matter of federal law. It's a form of sex discrimination. So Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 prohibits sex discrimination, and sexual harassment has been defined as a form of sexual discrimination. In fact, it's only unlawful under federal law if it is characterized as discrimination. Technically, the law doesn't require employers to take those actions, to have policies, to have training, but employers are more likely to have a defense against being held liable for sexual harassment if they do those things.
So it's a business, really, a business reason to do it sometimes for these companies.
That's exactly right. So without getting to the detail of the law, essentially if a supervisor engages in harassment, the employer can be liable, but the employer has a defense. And the defense includes, did the employer take action to prevent or correct, and did the employee fail to respond, fail to report?
Mm-hmm.
And so if an employer doesn't have a policy and doesn't do those things to enforce it, the employer is more likely to be held liable for the supervisor's harassment.
Dr. Paludi, do you think companies are doing their best to prevent sexual harassment now?
More companies do have in place these three components of what's typically referred to as reasonable care, the policy, procedures, and training. However, I must say that there's more that they can do, certainly ensuring that if we look at sexual harassment along a continuum of behavior in the workplace, leading up almost sometimes to, you know, to workplace violence, they need to intervene as soon as possible. They need to make it encourage women to come forward with their complaints, not prohibit them, and they can stress that during in the policy and training programs, for example, to make them feel that they're going to be listened to, that they won't experience retaliation, and to alleviate the concern. The great concern about feeling that what they say to an investigator in HR would be not kept confidential. So they can do more to encourage people to come forward with their complaints. And certainly the way they handle investigations is going to be crucial because it can have the effect of silencing other victims of sexual harassment coming forward if they feel they're not going to be heard, if there's going to be a breach of confidentiality, if mm-hmm. they're going to get a negative performance appraisal or even be fired coming forth.
Colleen from Bexley, you're on the air. Your comment.
Hi.
Yes.
Hello. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. Your comment.
Right. So I've had a couple of firsthand sexual harassment experiences in the workplace. I'm in college right now, but my first job when I was 16 was in a fast food restaurant. And I was sexually harassed by one of my managers in a physical and verbal way every day for the 2 years that I worked there. And I never felt that I could tell anyone because we were never educated about the resources we had. And people that were close to me just said, that's the price you pay for being beautiful. And we just went on. And today I know that what he did was completely illegal, but I never felt like I had the ability to come forward because it was a fast food place. And I was
and
so
you
young.
Were 16, right.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Colleen. We appreciate that comment. And Camille, if something like this does occur, whether you're 16, whether you're 25, whether you're 45, what should women do?
Well, the best legally, the best thing women can do is, in fact, report the harassment. Because if they don't report, in fact, they are very likely not to be able to bring a claim of sexual harassment, right? If they don't report it while it's happening or quickly after it's happening. And again, that's because of the two-part affirmative defense that I referred to earlier. But there are all sort of reasons why women don't report, mm-hmm. including the fact that they're afraid they're going to get fired.
Mm-hmm.
They're afraid that they're going to be humiliated, you know, sort of investigations, right? All those sort of things. And so while I say women should report legally because that's their best thing to protect themselves legally, I understand why women don't report.
Mm-hmm.
And then what I think the sort of next best thing, if you feel like you can't report because you're afraid you're going to get fired, et cetera, is to talk to other people about it, because I do think what allows harassment to continue is that people are silent. They don't think they can say anything. And so, right, people harass and don't get away with it. They continue to harass.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm Gail Hogan, and we're discussing workplace sexual harassment this hour. If you have a question or comment or you've experienced harassment on the job, give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email allsides@wosu.org. Dr. Paludi, I've heard that people should, if they feel sexually harassed, intimidated in the workplace, that the first thing they should do is try to deal with the situation themselves and approach that person who they feel is harassing them. Is that a good first step?
That's a very common response. I'm glad you asked about that. In reality, however, it's not going to be appropriate if the person who is sexually harassing you is your supervisor, someone who holds organizational power over you. People will feel less likely that they can confront this person, even in a gentle way, because of fears of retaliation. If it's a peer, and it depends on the type of sexual harassment, whether it be a comment that happened one time or it's repeated in a hostile environment situation, people may feel more likely to say something. But we need to look at the sexual harassment in terms of organizational power and the impact on victims, which would encourage them or inhibit them from coming forward. For example, there's a great deal of research indicating the significant impact on women victims of sexual harassment in several areas of their functioning, including emotional health, physical health, their interpersonal relationships, both outside as well as inside the workplace, and also their career development and wanting to stay in this particular job or not, and also their self-esteem and self-concept plummets. And so people feel that, you know, when they start getting when they're experiencing sexual harassment and these symptoms are kicking in, they're wondering if they should report, and they inhibit themselves initially. They try to reframe it, say it really wasn't harassment or I misunderstood, et cetera. And then when they get strength by talking with others in the workplace, family members, perhaps a therapist or family physician, they feel that maybe those internal approaches weren't working, so let me seek out a way to address it and confront it directly to the person they believe is sexually harassing them, or in the case of being a supervisor, to somebody in their HR department. And mm-hmm. I also wanted to say that I was sorry to the caller who talked about her experiences at 16. I'm very sorry that experience occurred to you.
Daniel, you're from Columbus and you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Gail, and thank you to your guest. I just wanted to make the point that, you know, we talk about what women can do in order to report or combat workplace harassment, but I think to your point earlier, it's definitely important for men to understand their role in that. Obviously, men played a huge part in creating the culture of harassment and making it okay. So we have to create the same culture where it isn't okay, and that men support women in the environment where when they hear reports like that or they overhear harassment happening, that they take action from that sort of sense of power so that the women don't feel alone. And a great way to do that is to include more women in the boardroom. Obviously, having more women in the boardroom isn't related to quotas or anything, but it's related to having more intelligent and careful and better perspectives to share. The more diverse the boardroom looks, the better the culture is, and the easier all these things will be to happen. So thank you.
Thank you, Daniel. And I think both Camille and Dr. Paludi would agree with that assessment.
Oh, that's exactly right. And I do think, you know, it's easy when you're talking about sexual harassment and you fall into this, you know, all the men are bad and all the, you know, that sort of thing is to really recognize that men can play. I mean, in addition to men sometimes being the subject of harassment, and they are, that is a target of harassment, but also that their support, which is either even just telling other people to knock it off, other men to knock it off, right? This isn't funny. This mm-hmm. isn't acceptable. Mm-hmm. I think gives other men a sense of what's appropriate and women a sense of a protection of power, right? Other people recognizing it's not just them that realize this is inappropriate.
Dr. Paludi, if a person feels sexually harassed at work or uncomfortable with certain situations, then what are some of those strategies or the steps that they should take to either stop it or take action? What is the process?
Well, they should be familiar with their company's policy and procedures on the issue. And certainly, if the company had annual training on sexual harassment prevention, part of that training would be giving the employees information about what their rights and responsibilities are should they want to file a complaint or a respondent or a witness for either side. So they should know to whom to complain. If it's a person in HR, typically it is somebody who has specialized training in these issues and the law as well as the psychology of sexual harassment, and they should find out if they can take oral as well as written complaints, how long the investigation will take, if they have a witness or more than one witness to come to their present information that would support their complaint, to find out how retaliation will be prohibited, and if they feel they were retaliated against, for example, on a performance appraisal, how the HR department will deal with that separate investigation, and also they need to know how their confidentiality will be protected, and to provide any documents, text messages, anything they have that they believe will be supportive of their complaint. And the responsibility on the part of the employer would be certainly to take all of the information presented to them, to be a calming force for this, because sexual harassment is because of the symptoms that I mentioned earlier, individuals have heightened hypervigilance about what's going to happen to them once they file a complaint. They're concerned, they're fearful of retaliation. And the other thing that I want to mention is that when women do come forth, they need to know that sometimes others with whom they work might not be supportive. And while I agree with the last caller about the men being instrumental in helping with this issue, other women need to be supportive of women who come forth as well. Sometimes they have been sexually harassed and they did not come forth, and they internalize the anger that they have, and they might also then lash out at somebody they know who has come forward. Other women need to understand that this is not something that is made up, that it's not a joke, it's not a compliment, it's not flirtation. So that would be important, for example, to cover in a training session. But without having any kind of policy and understanding the procedures, then women are going to be less likely to know what they have to do. That's the responsibility on the part of the organization to inform them. Also, it's important, should they feel, not because they're crazy or they've made this up, but very often we have to inform complainants that it would be very helpful if they sought out somebody from the Employees Assistance Program, a social worker, or a therapist in their community to help deal with what they're going to experience once they've put the company on notice.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to direct this to Camille. We talked about women's role, but another role I would think, if you feel harassed, you might want to look around and see if other women in your company are experiencing the same thing from someone. I would believe there's power in numbers.
I do think there is power in numbers. I think, so if I can use the most recent incident at Fox News as an example, right? So the first woman that came forward, the response was, oh, this didn't really happen. This is just somebody who's disgruntled. But it's really hard to do that when it's 10 or 20 women coming forward. There is certainly power in numbers.
We're talking about sexual harassment in the workplace. Coming up, the emotional toll of harassment on the job. And Dr. Paluti, you hinted at that. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Gail Hogan. This hour, we're discussing sexual harassment in the workplace. Still with us is professor at Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law, Camille Hebert. Thank you still for being here, Camille. And also with us by phone, psychologist and human resources consultant, Dr. Michelle Paluti. And listeners, we'd like to hear your experiences on this issue. If you have been a victim of harassment or as a manager dealing with this report of harassment, give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email allsides@wosu.org. Dr. Paluti, you alluded to the emotional and psychological trauma that sexual harassment victims deal with. And that's probably at the time they're experiencing it, but then also you seem to suggest once they report it, there's another set of emotional turmoil.
Yes, exactly. The people who experience sexual harassment commonly experience anxiety, depression, strong fear reactions, disruption of their lives. There's decreased motivation. And once they do file a complaint, there's additional anxiety and worry and because of fears of retaliation. And if that does occur to the complainant, then all of those symptoms I just mentioned become stronger. And very often they have been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder as a result of the initial sexual harassment and then any continued harassment on the part of coworkers because they know that this person filed a complaint as well as some retaliation on the part of the organization. They also experience sleep disturbances, disordered eating, gastrointestinal disorders, crying spells, and they exhibit what's been referred to in the research literature as a post-abuse syndrome that's characterized by shock, emotional numbing, a constriction of affect, flashbacks, and additional signs of anxiety and depression.
Wow. Debbie from Columbus, you're on the air. Your comment, please.
Hi, thank you for taking my phone call. I'm almost 60, and back to mid to late 60s, I'm working in a factory that had very few people of color. And I guess sometime between 65 and 68, a Caucasian foreman had approached her and said something very crude and sexual to her. She's very quick on her feet, and she said, "How would you like if my husband did to your wife?" In other words, a black man to a white woman. And he thought about it, and from then on, she had no problem, but she got lucky. One quick thing. I worked at a job in the late 90s, and I knew the CEO very well, a small company. And I said, I noticed that behavior towards so-and-so. Based on talking to a lawyer friend of mine, I can be a witness for somebody, and that could hurt you. I don't want to do that, so please don't do it again. So people need to know that third party can't complain. That's my comment.
All right, Deb, thank you very much. Very interesting. And Camille, since we're talking about what happens when someone reports, does this emotional upheaval when they're going through it and then thought of coming forward keep some victims quiet?
Oh, I think that's exactly right. I mean, I think a lot of victims are quiet because they don't like what's happening to them, but sometimes what may happen if they complain would be worse,
mm-hmm.
right? And sometimes, curiously, it's even women not actually wanting the harasser to be fired. They just want the harassment to stop, right? And so sometimes they don't report because they don't want to get him or her whatever in trouble, right? So you have all those sort of things. But I do think it is both the trauma that can be involved in certain types of harassment and also sort of the fear of what's going to happen. It's unlawful to retaliate, by the way. It's unlawful to fire you or take action if you are because you've complained of sexual harassment. But that doesn't mean it doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm. Sandy, you're from Columbus and on the air. Your comment, please.
Hello. I wanted to say that going to HR isn't necessarily the best strategy for women because the purpose of HR is to protect the organization from its employees. And what generally happens, especially in a large organization, is that once a complaint is lodged with HR, their first response is going to be red alert, red alert. They're going to go to the supervisors, including the people who perhaps were doing the harassing, and strategize on ways to diffuse the situation. And oftentimes, this is not going to be for the benefit of the woman, assuming it's a woman who is being sexually harassed. So going to HR oftentimes is not at all helpful for women, and it can be just the opposite. And I'll listen offline.
All right, Sandy, thank you. And Dr. Paluti, you are a consultant, a human resources consultant. So what do you think of her comment and how she feels about HR?
I can understand her comment, and in fact, I'm sure that there are HR departments who aren't as sensitive to these issues as they should be. Part of my work over the years has been to train HR professionals to understand the psychological issues involved in this, as well as their legal responsibility, and to help with ensuring confidentiality. They also have a responsibility to the employees, as well as to the employer, and they have to understand that failure to respond or to
promptly, impartially, in a confidential way will increase the individual's likelihood to go outside of the organization to their state's human rights division with a complaint, or to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission to file their complaint. And their organization's failure to respond appropriately will put them at severe risk if the individual goes outside of the organization to file a complaint, which should be they should be informed about that in the policy and in the training programs.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm Gail Hogan. We're discussing workplace sexual harassment. Give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email allsides@wosu.org. Camille, our conversation this morning on sexual harassment has dealt with women, but are men sexually harassed in the workplace?
Yes, they are. Now, in fact, statistically, men who are sexually harassed in the workplace tend to be harassed by other men.
Okay.
But there are some instances of females harassing males, but certainly the reported cases, but even most cases, I don't mean cases that are reported like in surveys, mm-hmm. most of the harassment of men tends to be same-sex harassment by other men.
And is that percentage still much lower than the number of women who are sexually harassed in the workplace?
Yes. If women tend or harassed much more often than men. In the workplace, statistically.
If a woman accuses a coworker of sexual harassment, do others in that same company seem to have empathy toward her, or are women being shunned if they speak up? And you addressed this, Dr. Paludi, a little bit. Camille, what do you think? And we've heard it before with women not necessarily backing each other up on other issues. So how do women treat other women when they bring this up?
I think it varies a lot. I mean, I think it depends on probably sort of all sort of things about the culture of the workplace. So sometimes I have seen women be very supportive of other women. On the other hand, I've also seen situations in which women are hostile to other women. And whether it is because they lived through it and they sucked it up and they didn't complain and they're offended for that reason, or whether they're threatened by sort of, you reported I didn't, you know, all those sort of things. It is true that often women, when they face retaliation, it can be from other women.
Which is really sad.
It is very sad.
Dr. Paludi, what does the future look like in regards to sexual harassment in the workplace? Are you seeing very much improvement?
Well, it's a good question, because I started all of my work a few years before the Hill-Thomas hearings. And in looking back over 25, 26 years, I have seen great improvements in terms of organizations taking their responsibility through policy, procedures, training, more sensitivity to the fact that they need to, as one of your callers suggested, hire more women, especially, and also people of color, in dealing with these issues. And the training programs are very helpful so that individuals can know what their rights and responsibilities are. I just wanted to mention that one of the things that we've seen over the years is that sometimes women don't come forth because they are concerned that they too will be harassed and retaliated against. And we need to look at, in addition to the symptoms I mentioned, the fact that there's an economic loss for women if they have to be constructively discharged, they'll leave their employee. It's difficult to find other work. So it's really important to keep this issue very much in the forefront so that women and men understand what sexual harassment is, and to stop making jokes about it, as that sometimes still occurs. I've seen that lesson over the years, but it's still a concern to me. And I also know that part of the change that's taken place over the years is to look at the intersectionality of racism and sexism, and the fact that women, especially women of color, experience much more sexual harassment on the job. And I'm not sort of pitting women against each other, but we need to understand that perhaps some people may not come forth because they are uncomfortable filing race complaints as well as sexual harassment complaints. So I've seen those changes. I don't want to discourage any of your callers
on your listeners, but I have to say that this isn't an issue that we are through with. We have to keep vigilant, and we have to bring it down to the schools and do training and having children understand what sexual harassment is. And through college age as well. That's the next step that I've been working on the last few years to change people's perceptions. And programs like yours today will help increase the likelihood of people coming forth. And it also helps people with healing when they hear your guests talk about what sexual harassment is. They'll feel less likely that they're alone once they hear about the symptoms and about ways that they handled situations that perhaps others wouldn't have. Every situation's different. Power differentials in the workplace are very salient issues, and we need to understand that while we may not, as women, have responded to a sexual harassment incident the way this particular woman did, that we should respect her choice and understand that perhaps in that moment, in that time, this was what she could do in order to survive.
Camille, with the number of women now not being as afraid to take legal action, so because of increased cases, is that also proving to be a deterrent?
Oh, I think so. I mean, I do think that particularly when you see the high-profile cases, the head of Fox News losing his position essentially over it, I do think as you see people taking it seriously, more women are more likely to come forward. And I think as more cases reach the courts are more likely to take them seriously.
Mm-hmm. Jeannie, you're on the air. Your comment, please.
Yes, I wanted to ask a question. I live in Cincinnati, Ohio. What is the law for if you're being harassed by, say, upper management, but it's no one's ever around, it might be always done in private. What is the law based on if you can record the conversation as proof and evidence of harassment? Mm,
good question, Jeannie. That's interesting. Camille?
So the reason I'm wincing is because I'm trying to remember the rule is in some states you can record a conversation with the consent of just one party. I believe in Ohio, you can only record with the consent of both parties.
Hmm.
So I think I'm not positive, but I think there are some problems with recording.
But as we talked about before, that does really present a problem in the he said, she said type of incidents that occur, especially if it's with somebody who's a superior.
That's exactly right. It's a very difficult situation.
Dr. Paludi, your answer to that?
Well, we need to look not at the intent on the part of the individual engaging in harassment, but the impact on the victim. And clearly, as I mentioned earlier, there are clear-cut emotional, physical, work-related, and interpersonal responses that an individual who has experienced sexual harassment exhibits right from the time that the harassment starts. So we can look at whether or not their responses a research-derived and a clinically derived profile of victims of sexual harassment and focus on that. Individuals who do not experience sexual harassment will not experience any of those symptoms that I mentioned earlier.
Thank you both. That is all the time we have this morning. I would like to thank psychologist and human resources consultant Dr. Michelle Paludi for joining us today. Thank you, Dr.
Thank
Paludi.
You.
Dr. Paludi is an assistant dean at the Excelsior College School of Business. And thank you to Camille Hebert, a professor at Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law. Thanks for being in the studio with me, Camille.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you all for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.